Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
yeah. Don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia. We started to burn many things we found. That's the Gloria Starr Williams singing with Keith Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song, theme song of our show. And we are back for another great hour in Solartopia with an amazing guest, a college buddy of mine, amazingly enough. My classmate at the University of Michigan in the class of 1967, Bill Ayers. Bill, are you with us?
I am. Good to hear your voice, Harvey.
Well, it's good to hear yours, and it's great to see you here in Columbus, Ohio. You're coming through on your book tour. I can't even begin to give a biography of this guy. He has had one of the most amazing lives of any person I've ever met. When we parted company at the University of Michigan, you were off into the underground, and I was off into other things, but you just really blazed some paths in the radical anti-war movement and the movements for social justice, and we'll talk about that towards the end of the show. You then amazingly surfaced. You are the only person I ever went to school with whose wanted poster I pulled off a post office wall at in Massachusetts.
And I appreciate that because I didn't want it up on that wall, so thank you.
Yeah. I remember, but I actually gave it to you. In 1989, there was a reunion of radicals in Ann Arbor, and I took it up there for you. I had it on my wall in my room for a long time, actually. You then resurfaced, and you entered academia and got an amazing job and have had and continue to have an astounding career as an educator, and I do want to talk to you about that. But you do, Bill Ayers, have a book out now, and it just got a really glowing review from a guy I really respect. In fact, I just did a major peace conference with him in Washington, D.C., David Swanson, one of our most energetic, articulate leaders in the movement for peace. He had a beautiful conference in Washington, D.C. this past weekend. Allowed me to speak there against his better judgment, of course, but there were about 100 people there, and it was a wonderful, wonderful conference, and he really loves your new book, and you were here in Columbus talking about it, and I noticed you were in Washington, D.C. at Busboys and Poets. So tell us about this great new book you have out, and what you want the people to know from this writing that you've done.
Well, as you know, Harvey, mostly I write about education and about children and about urban schools, but I've written a couple of memoirs, and this book is something I've worked on off and on for 5 or 6 years. It's a tiny little book. It's almost a pamphlet, but it's called Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto, and the title comes from a piece of graffiti that was seen on the walls of Paris in 1968, which The full graffiti was, be realistic, demand the impossible. And I kind of like that contradiction because for me, one of the great problems of American politics is that politics is always considered the art of the possible, which has not only compromise, but opportunism built right into it. And really, if you look at American history, and I know you've done a good, hard look at American history, I always refer to your book, Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States, which I absolutely loved. I think you wrote it in the 60s. But if you take a look at history, you realize that the kinds of fundamental changes that we all admire and salute today are changes that came about because activists rose up and demanded the impossible, organized mass movements to bring about what was unthinkable shortly before. And so I can think of more modern examples, but if you go back a ways, it was the abolitionists in the 1850s who were demanding the impossible. It was the suffragettes who were demanding the impossible at the turn of the last century. And we have to get into the mode of breaking from the terms of the debate that are given to us on the major issues facing us and say, no, we don't accept those terms. We want to demand the impossible, which is to say a more utopian view, a more idealistic but not necessarily unrealistic view.
Well, be specific about that, Bill Ayers. Tell us what impossible things should we now be demanding?
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. There are the book opens with a plea to unleash our radical imaginations and to think more broadly about what it is we want. And that plea is situated in my own mind in the fact that even though I've been on the left my whole adult life, and even though I still consider myself a revolutionary, and even though some would describe me as part of the far left or the lunatic left, the reality is I think in this country I'm in a majority on most issues. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One chapter, there are eight substantive chapters. One chapter is called free healthcare. And I want to break from the idea that the debate should be between Obamacare or the health, the health insurance industry unchained. That's not the debate I want to have. I want to have a debate about whether universal free health care should be available to everyone in this country, as it is in many major industrial countries. And on that issue, I'm in the majority. I'm not as some kind of barricaded, precious person with some idiotic ideological idea. I'm in the majority. Most people agree that universal free health care is a reasonable thing. Now, some of the other issues, I may be a little, I may be framing it a little more dramatically, but I think when you get down to talking about it, I find myself in agreement with most people in this country, and I don't feel barricaded. But these aren't the discussions or conversations we're having. For example, in this presidential campaign, one of the issues that I think are of central importance are really on the agenda. In fact, the other night while I was at Busboys and Poets and watching the debate with hundreds of other people, I began to write out questions that I would ask if I were the moderator, and not get stuck in the kind of terms of the discussion that they were stuck in.
Well, let's hear some of those questions. What would you have asked Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton?
You know, the first question that occurred to me, was something like, do you consider education, public education, a human right or a product to be sold at the marketplace? Now, that's a question that actually gets at the heart of the matter. It's not a question of, you know, should we tinker with this school? Should we add more money to this inner city school? It's a question of, do you believe that education is a human right, that you have a right to it, which incidentally is codified in Article 26 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which we are a party to. So that was the first one that occurred to me. But then as I was listening, I thought somebody should ask them, should Edward Snowden be pardoned or given the Presidential Medal of Freedom? How about Leonard Peltier? How about Oscar Lopez? I'm kind of jotting these down on a napkin, you know. My next one was something like, what are five steps you advocate to begin to attack mass incarceration? What are five steps you could take as president that would begin to address this major social cancer? And then I get to even more controversial. Do you agree that the Palestinian people should enjoy the rights of all other peoples? And would you insist that Israel stop all settlements as a condition for any further aid? Right? I mean, these are things, obviously, that they might have more agreement. But at least I think they illuminate some of the problems that we face. The Edward Snowden question illuminates the fact that we live in a surveillance state. None of us voted for that. None of us want that. And again, there I'm in the majority, as are you.
Absolutely.
So that's the thing I was thinking about.
Have you seen Oliver Stone's movie on Snowden?
I have not seen it yet, but I've seen Oliver Stone himself interviewed 1,000 times. And I'm excited to see it. I saw Laura Poitras's film, of course. And that was very moving and very important, I think. But I hope Oliver Stone's done a good job. It sounds like he has. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
So how do you think the candidates would have responded to some of your questions?
Well, I think it would have been an agreement, and I think it would have done two things. One is it would have put them more on their heels because they're questions that they're not prepped for. This question about public education, they would hum and haw and talk about the need for accountability and the need for charter schools and so on. But that's not the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is, in a democracy, is public education a human right? And if it is, then what are you doing to support and endorse that human right? And I got into a discussion with I was interviewed on Book TV for C-SPAN, and the interviewer listened to me talk about schools, which I have written most of my books about, and about school reform. And he said to me, "Well, how would we pay for such a thing?" I don't remember what provoked him to say that. Is I said, "Look, whatever the most privileged and the wisest parents have for their children, in a democracy, we should insist that that's the base for education for all of our children. And anything less than that destroys democracy." So I pointed out that Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education for 7 years, superintendent of schools in Chicago for 7 years, comes back to Chicago after 14 years of telling us how to build better schools, and he can't find a single school for his children. So he sends them to private school. Now, how is that possible? How is that reasonable? And so I described the school that Arne Duncan's children go to. And it's a school with a class size capped at 15, with ample resources, with a full arts program, including orchestra and choir and fine arts and photography and theater. And it has 5 libraries and a curriculum based in part on pursuing kids' interests. And I said, if that's good enough for Arne Duncan's kids, why not for the rest of the people of Chicago? And his response was, how could we afford it? And my response to him was, if you think it's right, do you think it's right? And he said, I think it's right. I said, then we can figure out how to afford it. But it's getting people to agree that education is a human right, and that what the most powerful and privileged people have should be the baseline for all of us. Otherwise, you're basically saying that the crapshoot of how and where and to whom you were born is determinant in the life you're going to lead. That's not an essential part of democracy. That's a violation of democracy.
Yeah, you got that right, Bill. And of course, Obama has also sent his kids to private school.
That's the point. If you look at Sidwell Friends, where the Obama children go, and listen, I have no beef with them about that. They should go to Sidwell Friends. It's a lovely school. Several of my former students have taught there over the years, and I think that's terrific, and I think every kid should have it. The problem is they don't then advocate for every kid to have what their kids have. Instead, they say, your kids should go and do drill and skill, take multiple tests. Here's a real clear example. Arne Duncan's kids go to a school where they take less than a third of the tests that the Chicago Public School students take. Well, if it's good enough for his kids, why is it not good enough for the rest of us? And that's really the challenge we have to offer.
Well, articulate, Bill, your beef with testing. Why is it significant public schools have 3 times the tests the private schools do?
Well, there's a couple of reasons, but the one is that what they do, because they've reduced schooling, because the corporate school reform folks have reduced schooling to a matter of measure. To a single metric, they basically said that that the only way we'll know if you have an education is how you do on this single metric. But for the kids of the privileged, there are many ways to see how well they're doing, including participation and asking questions and so on. But as soon as you get an obsession with standardized high-stakes testing, what ends up happening is you strip the arts, you strip the sports, you strip the clubs, and you say everything for the test. It's actually a paradox that occurs in both physics and economics, and very, very tellingly in education. And it's the paradox is this: if you choose anything as the only way. Let me say it this way: a performance metric only works as a performance metric if you don't use it as a performance metric. That's called Goodhart's Law in economics. Why? What does that mean? It means that as soon as you say the universe I'm interested in is, say, a good high school, but the performance metric is how well you do on this standardized test, everybody's going to go for that standardized test. This is what just happened in Wells Fargo, incidentally, in the bank scandal that just happened. The performance metric of how you were doing in terms of getting your evaluation was whether you opened credit card accounts and bank accounts for customers. Well, everybody opened credit card accounts. The fact that they had to cheat and you know, commit fraud, that was just a byproduct. Are you following this? Because I can explain. I can keep explaining it. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but please do. Elaborate a little longer, because you know, I'm a college teacher,
I'll give you two more elaborations, two more examples.
Please.
So,
yeah.
If you say what we want in this community is a good hospital, Presbyterian Hospital. We want it to be a good hospital. The performance metric we're going to look at is how many days do you live after surgery? What's their mortality rate after major surgery? The Medicare standard is if you live 30 days post-surgery, that's considered a good outcome. If people have major surgery and they're still alive 30 days later, guess what? Presbyterian Hospital keeps everybody alive for 30 days, and on day 31, they start dropping like flies. Why? Because the universe that you're interested in is good hospital, but the performance metric is mortality after surgery. Second example from Chicago. The what you want is a good high school in this neighborhood, but the performance metric you choose is sends kids to college. Guess what? 100% of kids from urban prep go to college. And then you begin to say, well, what's a college? Well, Rose's Beauty School is a college. Some ripoff thing down the street is a college. And by the way, we push out 50% of the kids in that school because they're not going to go to college. So we brag about the fact that 100% go to college, but you'd be hard-pressed to say that that's a good high school.
Well, they go to Trump University, too. They got a great education there, I'm sure.
Well, there is that. They're not suffering the same thing. They've got a different fraud going on. But I do think it's very important to note that the children of the privileged are not taking tests. And the reason is frequent high-stakes testing is a threat to democracy. It restricts students' thinking. It leaves too little opportunity for the development of moral competence or critical inquiry. It produces subjects, not citizens. And so this is all well known. That's why the privileged don't obsess about it. But the rest of us have to be kind of put into this regime of test and punish.
It is amazing, actually. I was told a lot of charter schools do this. They get a big enrollment. They take everybody. They, you know, embrace special needs kids and the whole deal, and they keep them X number of days, which is required by the government to get their funding. And then at day plus one, they kick out half the students and send them into the public
exactly.
schools, which are then underfunded. It's a
well,
nightmare.
This is an old scam in Chicago, going back many years. When I was first teaching in Chicago, you got your funding based on your enrollment on, I think it was November 1st. And so principals spent enormous amounts of time getting kids enrolled on December 1st. But you were judged at the end of the year by how kids did on a standardized test in March. So between December and March, there was a lot of pushing out and finding alternatives because the test scores were going to be dragged down by kids who were marginal students. This is a terrible, terrible way to run schools in a democracy, and it should never be allowed. So that's a lot of what I do is spend time worrying about that. But the school example, Harvey, is just one example. I have chapters on war and peace, chapters on mass incarceration, the environment, health.
Let's go through some of these. So in your book, The Man, the Impossible, and by the way, the graffiti that I remember from the late 60s and early 70s at Ohio State, where you know I live in Columbus, Ohio, so I was going to the University of Michigan, but coming back to here, and the graffiti I remember on the wall at Ohio State was "Clapton is God," but that's a little different than "The Man, the Impossible." So, ironically enough, by the way, Eric Clapton now lives in Columbus, Ohio. Strange but true.
Wow.
He married He married a woman from Columbus. They have, I wouldn't say he lives here full time, but he does have a home here and a club of some sort. So, Bill Ayers, tell us about demanding the impossible when it comes to war and peace, because one of the issues, I'll tell you, if I was writing a questions for the debate, I'd say, well, when and how are we going to end the current state of perpetual war, perpetual imperial war in the United States?
Exactly.
So what do you say about that in your book?
Well, exactly. My question, just I'll say that, but my question would be, would you agree with closing all foreign military bases? You know, of course, they'd all go nuts and say no. But okay, so I have a chapter called Disarm, and each of the chapters begins with a little Harper's style index, which is a statistical portrait of what I'm going to talk about in the chapter. And this one, just a couple of items. The rank of the U.S. in military spending worldwide, number one. The percent of the world's total military budget that belongs to the U.S., 34%. The percent increase in U.S. military spending between 1998 and 2011, 88%. So the point is to point to, you know, what are the dimensions of the thing we're going to be talking about. So what I try to argue in the Disarm chapter is that we have squandered all kinds of opportunities to become a nation among nations by insisting that we are the uber nation and that we, you know, we go forth always with the idea that we're bringing peace and democracy. But the reality is that wherever the U.S. boot comes down, chaos and violence is sure to follow. And so I know we all kind of suffer living in the United States of amnesia, but the fact is that the wars, the permanent war that we're involved in, the permanent war economy, has created the conditions where not only is it destroying, you know, our own capacity to do the things we need to do as a society around schools and so on, but we also have created more chaos around the world, and we've created Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and all the rest of them are U.S. creations. The refugee crisis, which is all over the world now, millions of people on the move, that's a direct result of the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and then Iraq and then continuing from there into Yemen and other places. So we're not innocent in this. And I evoke a trailer that I saw once for a film. I think it was actually back in Ann Arbor when we were there. And I don't remember what the film was called, Invasion of the Martians or whatever. But each scene would begin with these mechanical aliens saying to a group of stunned Americans, we come in peace, just before they blew them away. And in a way, that's a metaphor for us. We always come in peace. We always come for democracy. But we always end up leaving wreckage in our wake. And that's what I try to illuminate.
Well, there is, and of course, this was underscored at this conference I just spoke at, David Swanson's World Beyond War conference. It was basically a business, and you know, your initial discussion here of the educational system, like mass incarceration and so much else that is wrecking our country, is that it's all basically corporate. It's all basically about business, and our whole foreign policy and our 800 or 900 bases around the world. By the way, I saw an interesting statistic. We have, it's classified, the exact number of bases we have. So nobody in the general public knows the exact number of military bases we have outside the borders of the United States. But I have read a statistic saying that we have somewhere out 800 or 900, and the entire population of the rest of the world, all the other countries in the rest of the world, have a total of 30 bases outside their own borders.
Wow. It reminds me, when I was at the World Social Forum in Brazil a few years ago, I was at a workshop where a guy had a world map, and he asked people to come up to the world map. People from all over the world were in attendance, and he wanted them to put a pin with a little banner on it if there was a U.S. military base in their country. And the world map was covered with pins. And then he said, now I want you to come up and put a pin in the United States, if your country has a military base in the U.S. And we all laughed. I mean, we would think it was absurd if there were an Italian air base in the Adirondacks. Why would we have an Italian air base in the Adirondacks? And yet the fact that we have U.S. air bases in the Italian Alps seems like common sense, but it's not common sense. And it creates all the distortions, both at home and abroad, that you and I are now referring to.
And it's a business, basically. War is a racket, and this whole national security industry is based on corporate profit, not on national security, which is a myth and certainly destroying the base of our country. I read, since you're in Chicago, I'm reading a book by Malcolm Gladwell called Blink, and he talks about going into the hospital in Cook County, and how an administrator came and tried to fix this place. It's the biggest kind of a hospital in Cook County. It's on, I think, West Van Buren, West Harrison Street. And and he's describing this hospital, which is a total, utter chaos. And just, you know, a place you would go to get sick and die, not to get cured. And I'm thinking, here we are, the richest country in the world, which we are, although about to lose that title. And we have hospitals like these where people are just falling off. What is your, you mentioned it in the beginning, but tell us about your impossible, demand the impossible in terms of healthcare. And you are familiar with hospitals in Chicago.
Before we get to, let me just say one other thing about, because you're talking here a little bit about what I consider social suicide. And in Chicago, and you're talking about the richest country in the world, in Chicago, where my granddaughters go to public school, my granddaughters have, in the six years they've gone to public schools here, they cut the arts, they cut the art teacher, and the parents banded together and raised money to hire an art teacher. Then they cut the music teacher. Then they cut all the sports programs to focus, you know, on drill and kill, on this kind of standardized testing. And then they required the kids to bring their own toilet paper to the schools in one of the richest cities in the richest country in the world. Now, how is that possible? So 2 years ago, our mayor, closed 50 public schools, mostly in black and brown communities. And then this spring, he fired 1,000 teachers under the guise of austerity. And last week, they hired 1,000 police officers. Now, if you can't see the equation there, that's what I consider social suicide. That's an unbelievable kind of illustration of where we're headed as a society. But let me fast forward to healthcare. So I basically argue that we should have free healthcare for all, which puts us kind of right in the middle of most countries. But I begin again with a kind of a Harper's Index type statistical profile. And I say the rank of the U.S. among 11 wealthy countries in health system performance, 11 out of 11. Rank of the U.S. among the countries of the world in annual per capita public and private health care spending, we're third. So our outcomes are 11th, our spending is third. Where does that money go? And I have many, many other statistics to point to. But what I'm basically arguing in this chapter, Harvey, is that capitalism and health don't go together. That actually, a lot of the stuff that we see and we either find amusing or appalling, for example, advertising on television for drugs, for prescription drugs, we're the only country in the world that allows that. And here you go on TV, and of course, we've given up. We've kind of cried uncle on the question of Viagra. We're going to see Viagra ads. They're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. And somebody's making money on that. We hear about things like the EpiPen scandal, right? And we say, well, how is this possible? Well, it's possible because capitalism is a profit-making machine. That's what it's for. Good medicine, at its heart, requires trust and an assumption of fairness. But that's not true of capitalism. Capitalism needs to sell product. And so you end up watching TV and you have all these invented diseases like low T. Have you heard of low T?
I think I drink low T. Isn't that like a, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah. That's because you're kind of a hippie. But the reality is low T is an invented disease that that you can see advertised on TV, and it shows a kind of a 40-year-old guy looking a little bit out of it at a party, and it says, Do you feel that you're not quite as with it as you used to be? Have you lost some of your edge? You can kind of see this guy's lost his charm, you know, and it says, maybe it's not you. Maybe it's a condition called low T. And you can buy this deodorant, keep it out of the hands of children, women, and pets. But you can buy this deodorant that will up your testosterone level, and then you'll be great. And what I always love about these ads on TV, you know, they'll say something like, just apply this special underarm deodorant, and then they get the warnings, the counterindications, and they say, keep it out of the hands of women and children, and it may cause uncontrollable itching or hearing loss or temporary blindness,
right.
Sneezing,
right.
Hiccups. Or maybe, seeing these ads,
How is
that possible? I'm sorry?
It may result in you shooting up at McDonald's, but other than that, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you end up reading the counterindication, and it's everything from rectal bleeding to tumors to, you know, frequent nosebleeds and suicidal thoughts. And you say, damn, is it worth it? I mean, but that's what – it's worth it if you're the corporation making money off of people's anxieties, fears, and doubts, and that's what they're pushing. They're pushing anxiety, fear, and doubt. Healthcare and capitalism don't go together. And that means we ought to get business out of the business of healthcare. And we ought to evolve toward a system that says there is no profit in healthcare. You can't make a profit in healthcare. It's, once again, a human right that all people should have access to the highest levels of healthcare available in that society.
Well, the bottom line in my world is you know, the term capitalism has been useful over the years and certainly applies in many cases. But in my world, in my estimation, the real problem is corporatism. Because the corporations, you know, we're always going to have small business. And I think there's a place in the world for small business. Even the most socialistic countries have always retained a marketplace in certain areas.
You and I agree on this. I'm using a broad brush, but absolutely, there's no society that would function without a market. You need a marketplace for sure. What you don't need is a marketplace, a market in people's health and survival. You don't need a market in education, because if you go in that direction around, or in elder care, because if you go in that direction, then the logic of the market holds, which is reduce costs and increase productivity and sell and it doesn't matter what, there's no ethics to it beyond sell, sell, sell.
Right. And so what we wind up with is human needs being subverted, subordinated to the profit motive. And the organ of that is basically become the corporation. And the corporation, to me,
is the
ultimate cancer that is really killing the human race and killing society, because you have the number one, the most powerful institution in the world now is no longer government, it's corporation. And corporations.
Yeah, we live in an oligarchy, absolutely. Absolutely.
And corporations now have human rights, but no human responsibilities. And
exactly.
I just showed my students a clip today of Orrin Lyons, the great Iroquois Haudenosaunee spiritual leader. I think he's an Onondaga, actually. Saying basically that, you know, the 100 most powerful institutions in the world, 49 are governments and 51 are corporations. And so you have the world of business being conducted by organisms that have absolutely no feedback in terms of the environment, in terms of human health and human justice. And so war, education, healthcare, they all become totally based on profit and not on serving human need. And I don't know if that's something. Well, demanding the impossible to me would be to get rid of the corporate.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. That's where the book is going, and that's where I conclude. The last chapter is called An American Dream, My American Dream. And it's a dream where we do away with this kind of being driven by this oligarchical, you know, capitalist marketed corporate culture, and we get back to, or we evolve toward, a sense of what are human needs. How can we as a community name the needs? I have a chapter called Love the Earth, which basically talks about the problem of creating a society where selling and buying is the whole name of the game, and we're forgetting that there's a finite earth here that we're plowing under, and we're, you know, monetizing and preying upon and extracting. And in, we have a choice that's become very stark. We can either save the earth and end capitalism, or we can save capitalism and end the earth. That seems like a very urgent and scary choice. Similarly, I dovetail from there into debt. I make an argument that we should cancel the debt, cancel the student debt, cancel the housing debt, and we should begin to do something that Martin Luther King talked about in 1967, which is go to a 30-hour week, go to a 20-hour week. We went from a 40-hour week. We're now up to most of us work 80 hours. It's ridiculous, when actually all we're doing is producing stuff that we, A, don't need, and B, is choking us on stuff. And so we need to think about a balance where we get down to the basics about what kind of a world do we want to live in? What are the challenges for the 21st century? What does it mean to be a human being in the 21st century? And we have to have that discussion, major discussion, far and wide.
Well, let's get into that. How do we restructure the economy to save the environment? What kind of institutional mechanisms can we put in place to stop the total, you know, the corporation is not human. It doesn't care. It's not an organism that is rooted in the earth. It's an organism that's rooted in profit. And the corporations are what are destroying the earth with the pipelines and the nuclear power plants and all the other crazy stuff that they're doing. So how do we do this? How do we step by step save the environment?
Right. Right. I'm not sure that I can tactically or structurally say this is the steps we should take. But what I do know is that we should be organizing around a vision that says this is where we have to go if we're going to survive. And we have to have a discussion about what kind of world we want to live in and how much stuff is enough stuff. So, for example, on transportation, I mean, that's one place where maybe the market is a good idea. On the other hand, we need to have a very serious conversation about what kind of transportation would be useful for all of us, what kind of transportation instead of kind of having the default position, we must have highways, we must have oil, we must have private cars. I think we need a more fundamental discussion about, you know, what human needs, you know, how to call out human needs. But I think I agree with you that as long as we're in thrall of corporations, they are non-thinking, non-reflective, non-human organisms that just plow forward without regard to consequences. And we see it every day, whether it's Wells Fargo or EpiPen or any number of other things, corporate school reformers. They're not thinking about the deeper questions of how do we want to live? Who are we? How did we get here? And where do we need to go to survive?
Well, you're talking to someone who's talking to you from Central Ohio, which is Columbus, Ohio, is the biggest metropolitan area in the country that does not have passenger rail service. We had a governor come in. We're all set. You cannot. The last passenger train left Columbus, Ohio, in 1979. You cannot take the train anywhere from here, and it is astounding to me. It is true. We are the largest capital city in the Western world without a passenger rail service. So and you know, our wonderful governor John Kasich, who is now considered a moderate, and who will be, by the way, and this is, we can segue into a little more discussion on the current political scene, but I will tell you that if Donald Trump loses, and by the way, John Kasich, John Kasich does have the power, as you know, I've written with Bob Fitricus many books on election theft, and I will tell you, without hesitation, given the electronic nature of the electoral system in this country, if it's a close election, and if it turns on Ohio, John Kasich and John Houston, who is the Secretary of State of Ohio, will have the ability to choose the next president around midnight, election night, when they are looking at the electronic machines and the interim results of the election, and they will have the power and the ability, with their IT guy, whoever they've contracted, to handle the electronic vote count. They will choose who will be the president. If it comes down to Ohio, it's up to John Kasich. He can choose Donald right. Trump or he can choose Hillary Clinton. Now, it is actually in his interest to have Hillary win. Because if,
so
if
that's
Trump
who he'll
loses,
choose.
Well, if Trump loses, John Kasich will become at least one of the very a small group of men who are going to be running the Republican Party. He has right. a very strong, the governor of Ohio, who's a Republican, has a very strong interest in Trump losing. Because if Hillary is the winner, he will John Kasich will be probably the presumptive nominee of the Republican
yeah.
Party.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to watch all of them because all of them are making a calculation based on Trump losing. So, you know, people are trying to keep a distance. People are trying to position themselves for 4 years from now. But I agree with you. I think Kasich has played it cleverly for himself.
Yeah.
There's no principle involved. It's just cleverness, you know.
Well, this is the guy who killed our passenger rail service. I mean, he came
right.
in. We had, as a result of, you know, a decade of really hard labor among a lot of people, including our Republicans. We finally lined up $400 million in federal money to restore passenger rail service in central in Ohio. It was going to go from Cleveland to Columbus to Dayton to Cincinnati. And then maybe across from Indianapolis to Pittsburgh. And he just flat out came in and said, we don't want your $400 million. And this is the guy who is likely, if Trump loses, to be the nominee of the Republican
yeah.
Party in 2020.
Well, the Republican Party is going to be reconfigured in the wake of Trump's catastrophic run. But I think what's interesting about your train example is that there's tremendous hostility in the U.S. Congress among the neoliberals and the conservatives, reactionaries, not only to the train service, which is appalling, but to the postal service. And you say, why do you hate the postal service? You know, why do you hate trains? Well, the hatred is based, again, on being in the thrall of big capital, and everything should be private. Everything private is good. Everything public is bad. And it's a myth, but it's been perpetrated on us, and it has some power. But we have now examples, lots of examples, Ohio being one, Michigan being another, of what it means to say we're going to run the state like a business. Flint, Michigan is running the state of Michigan like a business. And that's the catastrophe that you get when that ideology takes, you know, takes over and takes a life form. It's a horrible, horrible example, but it's an important example because this is what it looks like to say we're going to run government like a business. And that's what Trump is saying, and that's what most of the conservative party says.
Yes, and unfortunately, the Clintons have been saying that too. I mean, Bill Clinton, really, whatever grassroots small-D Democratic instincts the Democratic Party had, he turned over to the new Democrats in his term. And I tell you, man, Trump, the sight of Donald Trump makes me ill, but so does Bill Clinton. And I think it's not an accidental that all these articles are out about how he lost his mojo and no longer has charisma. I mean, people aren't stupid. And one of the reasons that Trump is doing well is because NAFTA was a catastrophe. I mean, it gutted yeah. this country. Bostrow was right yeah. about that. And
well,
now
no
we've got
question. There's no question that the Democrats and the Republicans, number one, they're the two major the biggest war parties ever assembled in the history of the world. Number two, they're both in the pocket of Wall Street. So that is all true. But I will stop short there because I actually think that what Donald Trump has done in the long-term damage that Donald Trump's candidacy has done is that he's created a vehicle whereby the base that's always there of white supremacy, the base of nativism, the base of know-nothingism, the base of hatred of foreigners has found itself, has found a coherent platform where they can see one another and become more powerful than they actually are. So I think, I actually think defeating fascism, defeating this, you know, crypto fascist movement is a long-term project, and it's not going to be defeated simply by Trump losing. So I think we have our work cut out for us in that regard. When Hillary Clinton wins, that's actually going to create the conditions for those of us who believe that we must create a multi-issue, interconnected, dynamic, progressive social movement. It's going to give us a lot of space to organize, partly because the moment we're living in. I mean, it's partly what Bernie Sanders created, but before that and deeper than that, it's what Occupy created, and even deeper than that, it's what the Black Lives Matter young people have created. We have brewing a really powerful, dynamic social movement, and I think on January 21st, you should be prepared to take to the streets and get out there knocking on doors and organizing, because we're going to have an open field, and Hillary Clinton herself, through the Democratic platform and so on, has agreed to certain things that are very good, and that we should not wait a minute to demand an end to war, $15 minimum wage, and so on.
Well, that's, and, you know, I think it starts on November 9th, the day after the election.
I agree. It's gonna be interesting. I think it starts now, Harvey. I mean, really, it starts now. But I'm just saying, there is no honeymoon here. We should begin. I mean, we should. People are organizing. I don't think there's a question of beginning. It's going on. But we should be prepared to leap in and take the moment for what it's worth and drive it as far as we can.
Well, what's really terrifying about Trump is not Trump himself. I mean, he's obviously
exactly.
But it's the size of his following, the size of the crypto fascist following is really what's disturbing. You know,
it's disturbing, but it shouldn't be surprising. It's disturbing, but if you look at Europe, if you look at the rest of the world, these fascist movements are on the rise, and they're on the rise for a very good reason. That is the crisis in imperialism, the crisis in capitalism, the crisis that's been created by permanent war, and these things are serious and abiding. So you look to Europe and you see these right-wing parties on the rise. They're terrifying, but they're not surprising, and it makes our work all the more clear and all the more urgent.
Yes, and we were talking before the show a bit about Jill Stein and the role of the Green Party. You want to talk a bit about that and how you feel about it?
Well, I live in Illinois. You pointed out that you live in Ohio, so your vote actually counts. I live in Illinois. My vote hasn't counted for a long, long time. And what I mean by that is, because of the Electoral College, this archaic holdover from slavery, my vote doesn't really count, so I can vote for whoever I want. And in Illinois, I'm voting for Jill Stein and Baraka. And I'm voting for that because I'm voting against Trump, but I'd also like there to be a left alternative. If I lived in Ohio, I would not vote for Jill Stein. And the reason is, it will actually it'll be throwing away your vote. Now, people say, here's what I find astonishing, a couple of things I find astonishing. Those who are kind of very, very forceful about the need for a third party, I'm not sure why they feel that we need it this minute, right now, and it's a matter of principle or moral stance. I don't see it as a moral stance. I always, all my life, I voted for the lesser of two evils, recognizing that the lesser of two evils is in fact lesser. So I voted for Bernie Sanders. Did I think Bernie Sanders would save us? Absolutely not. He's a Second Amendment nut. He's a pro-drone strike nut. No, I don't think Bernie Sanders would save us any more than I thought Barack Obama would save us. Hillary Clinton's politics are very, very, very close to Barack Obama's politics. You would have to show me where they differ, because I don't see it. So why the virulence about Hillary Clinton? Where is that coming from on the left among progressives? I honestly don't get it. And while I see the logic of a third party and the logic of breaking with the Democrats and the Republicans, the thing that you have to point to about the Green Party is it's been around for 30 years. What do they do between elections? There's no organizing. It's not a real organizing engine like the Workers' Party in New York or the Family Party in New York. It's not. It doesn't do that. So that's my critique of it. And when I hear people say, you can vote for the lesser of two evils or you can vote on principle, I don't buy that. Voting takes 5 minutes on one day every 4 years. Go ahead and vote. Sure, vote for the lesser of two evils because it's lesser, and then move on to spending the other 364 days doing the hard work of organizing, living a moral life, being a political activist and a good citizen. But don't throw your vote away for those 5 minutes simply because you're pissed off. That's a ridiculous, to me, that's a ridiculous waste.
I agree with you entirely, actually. I think what we need, I am not a fan of third parties because people spend so much time getting the proper positions and debating about this and that and candidates who then, you know, sell you out and all that stuff. I believe in a coalition of coalitions. I think that people should work on the issues that they work on, that they have an affinity for, that they love to do, that you love education. You know, I love the environment or working on the environment. We go where we're really good, which is nature's way, and then on the bigger issues, and when we need to come together, we come together. And
I think you're absolutely right, Harvey, and I think that if you look at history, just a simple glance at history, and you've done this more systematically than most, you can see that the great civil rights movement of the 60s, the 50s and 60s and 70s, Lyndon Johnson passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. He wasn't part of the Black Freedom Movement. Franklin Roosevelt passed the most far-reaching labor legislation and social legislation. He wasn't part of the labor movement. And Abraham Lincoln never belonged to an abolitionist party. We spend a lot of time gazing kind of helplessly at the sites of power we have no access to, the White House, the medieval auction block called the Congress, and too little time looking at the sites of power that actually could bring about change if we had this coalition of coalitions, or the way I think of it and the way I write about it in this book, if we reframe the issues and then connect the issues. War is linked to warming. The failure of the public schools is linked to the scapegoating of vulnerable groups and so on. If we can link the issues and build a powerful social movement, we can bring about the change we need, not by wishing that a savior would come along, whether it's Obama or Sanders or whoever, but by recognizing and having the confidence that we ourselves can change things when we're mobilized to do so.
Right, and I think it's beautifully stated, and I think that we have to recognize each other's expertise and each other's passion. I mean, I am actually an educator. I do speak at teach at colleges, which I absolutely love. I could not do pre-K and change diapers like you and my daughter have done. That won't happen in my lifetime. It was enough I had to change
right.
My daughter's diapers. I don't think changing other kids' diapers, that is not for me. But, you know, you have been able to do that. You're a spectacular expert in the field of education and much else. And that's what you should do. And then we deal with war and nuclear power and all these economic issues, social justice. We come together and we work together, but we maintain our expertise. And we don't try and beat each other up into a party operation. I mean, I love Jill Stein. I think she's a terrific candidate. She's doing a great service. But you got it exactly right. What does the Green Party and these other organizations do the rest of the time? Well, the rest of the time, those of us who are going to deal with her and vote Green, we work on our issues. And, and that's how it needs to work. Until another Eugene V. Debs comes along, who was able, you know, with his very particular charisma, to keep the socialist movement together. And Bernie had his moment. I'll be very interested to see what Bernie does on January 21st. Is he going to resurface?
Right.
Are we going to sustain the energy? What do you think?
Well, I actually think that I've never been able to predict the future, and the day before every revolution, it's impossible, and the day after, it seems inevitable. But I do think that we're going to see a crisis in the next several years around the two traditional parties. Both of them are going to have a crisis. And the crisis of the Republican Party is upon it. That is, a white supremacist, nativist branch could well break off in the next year. I have no idea if it will, but it could. And within the Democratic Party, the energy for a serious kind of democratic socialism is in the air, and it's on the ground. And I think that the Democratic Party, if they can't deal with that, it's at their peril.
Yes. Bill, I hate to say this. The first thing I hate to say is, but we only have 2 minutes left. So identify your, and by the way, were you active politically in the 60s and 70s? Maybe we should talk about that sometime.
You and I knew each other at the University of Michigan. I remember that I was one of the leaders of Students for Democratic Society. You were a very, very smart and clear reporter, editorial writer, and a very, very terrific newspaper called the Michigan Daily.
And here we are, all these
years
later.
I'm sorry?
We did. And here we are all these years later. Tell us the title of your book, where to get it, and your website.
We're down to the book of the answer. The book is called Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. It's published by Haymarket. It's available everywhere. I do hope people will take a look at it and it will be engaged in a dialogue that will build to the creation of a social movement that can really rock this country.
Hi, brother. You're just a great guest. Well, I have to have you back and find out what you did after college, okay, man?
Okay, we'll do it.
We'll talk to you next time. Bill Ayers, thank you so much. And thank you, crew in New York.
Thank you, Harvey.
All right, brother. See you in Solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way.